In ancient Israel, for example, visionaries encouraged them by sleeping amongst tombstones. The Bible contains several instances of prophetic dreams. Not all supernatural dreams belong to the distant past. There is a substantial literature of more modern dreams. In the 19th century, several newspapers reported that an unnamed gentleman in Cornwall, England, dreamed of the assassination of the British Prime Minister, Spencer Percival, 8 days before it happened on the 11th of May 1812. He dreamed he was in the lobby of the House of Commons and saw a man in a brown coat approach a small man in a blue suit and shoot him in the chest. The dreamer questioned a bystander and was told it was Percival who had been shot. Next day he discussed it with his wife and a circle of friends, but was dissuaded from trying to warn Percival by the argument that it was only a dream, and he would be regarded as a fanatic. Percival's assassin, a Mr. Bellingham, a deranged bankrupt with a financial grudge, was later hanged for the crime. Unfortunately, there were no newspaper reports of the dream before the assassination, but Dr. John Abercrombie, a turn-of-the-century parapsychologist, traced the dreamer and was assured in writing that the claims were true. A better attested example of a precognitive dream occurred on the 28th of June 1914, to the Balkan Bishop of Nagyvarad, a Monsignor Joseph Delany, who was also tutor in Hungarian to the Archduke Francis Ferdinand, ruler of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. In the early hours of the morning, the bishop dreamed he was sitting at his study table reading a black-edged letter which bore the coat of arms of the Archduke. The letter said, "Your Eminence, my wife and I have been victims of a political crime at Sarajevo. We commend ourselves to your prayers." In his dream, Delany saw the Archduke and his wife seated in a motor car, along with a general and another officer next to the chauffeur. Two young men stepped up to the car and fired at the royal couple. The agitated churchman woke his mother and told several friends of his dream. He also wrote down the details. That afternoon, a telegram arrived with news of the assassinations that day at Sarajevo, the direct cause of the First World War. This dream was reported by a famous French parapsychologist, Dr. Charles Richer, who enhanced his reputation as a scientist in 1913 by winning the Nobel Prize for Medicine. The well-documented world of crime and police investigations has many examples of dreamers who seem to know the unknowable. Around the beginning of this century, an American woman, a Miss Loganson, aged 19, dreamed in her Chicago home that her brother Oscar had been murdered by a neighboring farmer at Mingo, 50 miles away. Miss Loganson sent a telegram to her brother and received a reply saying that he had disappeared. She made a great fuss and accused a farmer named Bedford of murder. Eventually, Miss Loganson, with police and another brother, visited Oscar's home at Mingo. They found bloodstains and the sister showed police where to dig. Under some stones in a yard, they found the brother's body just as she had seen it in her dream. The neighboring farmer, Benson, was subsequently hanged for murder. Famous individuals have had impressive dreams, although not necessarily supernatural in origin. The epic poem Kubla Khan came to Samuel Taylor Coleridge, according to his own account, in a dream induced by laudanum. Next morning he was writing down all he could remember when he was disturbed by a knock at the front door. Later he was unable to recall the end of the poem, which remains unfinished. The German writer Goethe says he got poetry from his dreams and also solved scientific problems whilst asleep. Robert Louis Stevenson says plots for novels came to him in dreams, and Charles Dickens acknowledged that some of the characters of his novels appeared fully formed in his dreams. The American chess genius, Frank Marshall, used to take paper and pencil to bed every night, to write down chess combinations that came to him in his sleep. The famous Marshall variation was invented in this way. There are many more examples of strange dreams, yet what inspires them is as uncertain today as ever. Opinions are as varied as the views of three of this century's most celebrated psychoanalysts: Adler, Jung and Freud. Alfred Adler was sure dreams were only a reflection of events in the dreamer's life. He regarded the paranormal as superstition. Carl Jung accepted the reality of both telepathic and prophetic dreams and wrote with great insight of his own remarkable dreams. Sigmund Freud, more equivocal in some of his utterances about dreams, nevertheless wrote that it was incontestable that sleep created favorable conditions for telepathy. Freud speculated that telepathy might have been the original archaic method of communication, the way individuals understood one another before telepathy was pushed into the background by better methods of being understood, such as sign language and speech. Under certain conditions, said Freud, older methods of communication, like telepathy, might still manifest themselves. In a sense, it was to test the truth of such statements that Montagu Ullman set up his dream laboratory. He wanted to see if telepathy could manifest itself in modern dreams. The dream laboratory came about partly because of Ullman's early experiences with the paranormal. He stressed that scientifically there was no significance to this part of his life, but his brushes with psychic phenomena as a student set him on his path in life. At college, a friend claimed to have had poltergeist experiences, and they set up a small group to study psychic phenomena. For 2 years Ullman and five other students met every Saturday night round a bridge table in a darkened room. We tried out many of the things we read about in the classic literature and ultimately things began to happen. I won't go into it in any great detail because it may sound rather incredible, but they did include levitation of the table at one point. There was also writing that occurred without any of us holding the pencil. Also so-called thought photographs, where something appeared on an enclosed photographic plate, which was not exposed and which pertains to something we were thinking about. We weren't scientists performing under controlled conditions, but out of those days a solid friendship evolved that lasted to the present day. As to what it meant, reviewing our experiences 35 years on, we each came to the conclusion that we weren't clever enough to have fooled ourselves by inventing the range of phenomena that seemed to occur. Dr. Ullman put these youthful experiences behind him while he trained as a psychiatrist and served overseas in the Second World War. Later, as a practicing psychoanalyst in New York, his active interest in strange phenomena was revived by certain patients, lying on the couch in his consulting room, telling him about their dreams. Some described images and events from Ullman's life, which he did not believe they could have known through any normal channels. When you're at the receiving end of something like that, it carries a wallop, it really touches you. It is less convincing to a skeptic because it's not occurring under controlled conditions, and I can't guarantee these patients weren't somehow privy to what was happening in my private life. But it was a powerful experience for me. In 1948. He joined a small group of New York analysts and psychiatrists to form a medical section of the American Society for Psychical Research. They met regularly for several years, and spontaneous examples of telepathy by dreaming patients were regularly discussed. Then in the 1950s, two developments paved the way for dream telepathy experiments. Research at the University of Chicago established that a sleeper's brainwaves, measured on an electroencephalograph, EEG, changed when he was dreaming. It was also noticed that in dreams, a sleeper made rapid eye movements, REM, as if the eyeballs were scanning from side to side under closed eyelids. Although most people find it difficult to recall their dreams the following morning, someone who is awakened immediately a dream has finished has little difficulty in recalling it. By monitoring a person's REM and EEG reading, it was now possible to wake someone the moment a dream had finished and have him recall the dream fully. The stage was set for dream telepathy experiments. But Ullman needed an EEG, a sleep laboratory and some suitable assistants. A renowned psychic, Mrs. Eileen Garrett, an Irish woman who played a leading role in parapsychological research, came to the rescue. As president of the Parapsychology Foundation, she saw the value of dream telepathy experiments and put two rooms at the foundation at Ullman's disposal. One was fitted out as a sleep room and the other had an EEG installed. Two parapsychologists were assigned to help, one of whom was Dr. Carlos Sozis. The first subject for the experiments was Eileen Garrett herself, who had achieved considerable fame as a medium when she apparently communicated with the spirit of the dead captain of the Royal Airship, after it had crashed in France in 1930, but before the news became known. One of the early tests was particularly successful. In October 1960, Garrett retired to the sleep room with a few electrodes attached to her head. A target pool of pictures was selected by Dr. Osas and sealed in separate envelopes. Dr. Ullman was to choose one at random and try to send the image to the dreaming Eileen Garrett in her soundproofed room. Waiting for Garrett's first dreams to begin, Dr. Ullman was thinking about the book Spartacus by Howard Fast, the story of a slave rebellion against ancient Rome. Doodling, he drew some crucified figures representing the eventual fate of the leaders of the rebellion, according to the book, which was made into a successful film. Woken up after her first dream, Garrett said, "I went to see a Roman picture. I think Spartacus was the thing I was going to see, but I never went inside. I was standing on the outside looking at pictures of Roman soldiers." The target in Ullman's sealed envelope was a photograph of a doctor examining a patient. After his apparent success in transmitting his own thoughts, Dr. Ullman decided to continue to improvise. He sketched the outline of a sword for Spartacus and a stethoscope for the doctor. He tried to transmit these images along with the photograph. Mrs. Garrett's fifth dream seemed to contain these various elements. "I saw my doctor yesterday and he was at the Olympic Games. We talked about the Olympic Games and Rome. Then I saw a picture of two men and they were swordsmen, but that again may be something to do with him because he is a fencer." Other promising experiments so encouraged Dr. Ullman that in 1962 he opened the Dream Laboratory in part of Maimonides Medical Center, Brooklyn. The first Dream Laboratory devoted entirely to ESP experiments was made possible by funding obtained by Dr. Gardner Murphy, a distinguished psychologist who became president of the ASPR. 2 years later, Dr. Stanley Krippner, a psychologist with an interest in the paranormal, joined as director, and tests proper began in the summer of 1964. The story of the next 4 years is told in Ullman and Krippner's most readable book, Dream Telepathy: Experiments in Nocturnal ESP. In the first tests, a dozen enthusiasts, seven men and five women, were the dreamers. Each separately underwent 6 nights of tests over a period of months. With electrodes attached, each was invited to fall asleep and dream. Eye movements and egg readings showed when dreaming had begun, and a signal was flashed to an agent or sender in a remote part of the building, whose job was to transmit an image of an art print, randomly selected after the subject had fallen asleep. This could be any picture from a set of 12, chosen for emotional impact and vividness. When it was seen that dreaming had stopped, the sleeper was woken up and invited to dictate the dream into a tape recorder. This process, using the same target, was repeated throughout the night, and sometimes up to 6 dreams were recorded. Next morning, transcripts of all the dreams and copies of the 12 prints from which the target was chosen were sent to 3 independent judges. Their job was to number the pictures, 1 to 12, in the order each felt best matched the content of the night's dreams. The dreamer was also asked to judge which picture had been the target. At this stage, only the sender had any idea which picture had been used. If the judges all picked the correct target, the night's experiment was a direct hit. If they placed the picture among their top 6 choices, it was a hit of sorts. A place in the bottom 6 was a miss. The odds for guesswork meant there was a 50-50 chance the target picture would end up in this top 6. To suggest telepathy, a series of experiments had to score significantly more hits than misses. The first 2 subjects, tested for a total of 12 nights, scored 8 hits and 4 misses. Telepathy was a possible hypothesis, but not demonstrated statistically. However, when the 2 subjects' own rankings of the pictures were taken into account, the score improved to 10 hits with only 2 misses. Statistically, this was evidence that the subjects had elements of the target pictures in their dreams. It became clear that the dreamers were better than the independent judges at identifying the target picture. The dreamers seemed able to recognize their dreams by nonverbal associations. The judge's only guideline was the recorded utterances of someone who had just been woken up. After 24 nights of tests, ESP rather than chance seemed to have been demonstrated. There were 19 direct or partial hits and only 5 misses, but the skeptics said the Dream Lab was just having a run of good luck. And there were not that many direct hits, which perhaps indicated to the critics some lack of clear telepathic input. But direct hits there certainly were. As with the later Ganzfeld tests, the dreamers sometimes picked up the target very clearly, and at other times the ESP seemed more oblique. An obvious direct hit was the dreamer whose target picture was a painting by Bellows of a world heavyweight boxing match at Madison Square Garden. He said, "Something at Madison Square Garden. A boxing fight." A more subtle direct hit came from a woman writer. The target picture was a crystal Easter egg by Faberg. This apparently caused her to dream of two huge heads, one Polynesian and one Egyptian. Next day, she had no difficulty in nominating the egg as the target for her dream. At the outset there were two huge heads. They were very Egyptian because the men were bald. There were some statistical failures and some subjects were better at it than others. A real star was psychologist Dr. William Irwin. Until he was taken seriously ill after the 7th of a series of tests, Irwin had scored 5 hits with 2 misses. His hits were so highly ranked that the independent judges and the statistics supported the hypothesis of telepathy. The odds against lucky guessing were given at 1,000 to 1. It was another 2 years before Irwin was well enough to participate in a further series. By then attempts to influence the dreamer were more sophisticated. Researcher Sol Feldstein made drawings and concentrated on objects as well as the picture. For instance, a boxing glove was used to reinforce the image of a prize fight. One of Irwin's target paintings was Downpour at Shono by Hiroshi Ige, and as part of his transmission, Feldstein took a shower. Irwin's guess the following morning was something to do with fountains, maybe water. The use of multisensory targets produced extraordinary results. 6 of Irwin's second series of 8 sessions were all direct hits and the other 2 were very high hits. The statistics suggested telepathy was occurring. The experiments became more ambitious. ESP images were transmitted to dreamers from locations miles away from the sleep room, and with some success. Of course, they didn't top astronaut Ed Mitchell's ESP test in 1971 when he tried to send telepathic messages 200,000 miles across space from the Apollo 14 mission. He did not have U.S. Space Agency approval for his tests and the results were said to be borderline and ambiguous. Eventually, the Dream Lab at Maimonides tackled the big question. Could someone dream of a future event, which had not even been planned at the time of the dream? Is precognition a psychic reality, and does it occur in dreams? A young man with recognized psychic ability, Malcolm Besant, was chosen in 1969 to be the subject. His task was to dream about some unknown experience that would happen to him the following morning. For the first test, Besant simply went to sleep and was woken up at intervals throughout the night to record his dreams in the normal way. Next morning, after transcripts of his dreams were sent to independent judges, Stanley Krippner began to plan a powerful experience for Besant. Nothing had been decided in advance, to guard against the possibility of the dreamer getting hold of the information by telepathy. Dr. Krippner, with no idea what Besant had dreamed, was given 2 numbers, selected by someone else, and these were used to produce at random a keyword from a book of prose. The word was corridor. Krippner then went to their large collection of art prints and selected an appropriate picture. It was Hospital Corridor at Street Remy by Van Gogh, showing a lone figure in a corridor of a mental hospital. The task was to construct a sensory experience for Besant so powerful it might have been reflected in his dreams the previous night. Dr. Krippner decided to treat Besant almost as if he were a patient in an asylum. When Besant appeared he was, without explanation, called Van Gogh by everyone. To background music of Ross's Spellbound, mixed with the sound of hysterical laughter. Besant was shown paintings by mental patients and was made to taste medicine with a glass of water. He was disinfected by being dabbed with acetone. Then he was led by Krippner, dressed in a white hospital coat, through a darkened corridor. He was shown Van Gogh's picture of the lone mental patient. Details of this sensory experience were sent to the judges, along with 7 other possible experiences and different key words. These were all to be ranked against Besant's dreams the night before. From his first dream, Besant recorded an impression of green and purple, small areas of white and blue. This was a fairly good match for the colors in Van Gogh's painting, which are predominantly orange, green, blue and white. After his second dream, Besant said, there was a large concrete building, it was architecturally designed and shaped, and there was a patient from upstairs escaping. It might have been a woman. She had a white coat on, like a doctor's coat. He also said, I felt that a Negro patient had escaped. He or she had put on a doctor's white coat and got as far as the archway. These statements seemed to match the painting of the patient in the corridor, perhaps even with the addition of Krippner's white coat. In this third dream, Besant seems to refer directly to the strange treatment he received from his colleagues at the Dream Lab. Something I had done aroused hostility in people. It had to do with my work, and I think all the people were medical. All the judges correctly picked corridor and the Krippner sensory experience as the one that best matched Besant's dreams the previous night. It was a direct hit for precognition. In all, Besant took part in 8 tests of this type and scored 5 direct hits and 2 hits in the top half of the judges' scorecards. Statistically, the odds against this happening by chance were given as 5,000 to 1. Had the dream laboratory therefore shown that people can glimpse the future in their dreams? Not conclusively, said other parapsychologists. They pointed to a loophole in the argument. The interesting possibility that Dr. Krippner might have telepathically picked up what Besant was dreaming the night before. Perhaps the sensory experience had been tailor-made to match the dream, since after the word corridor was randomly obtained, the experiment was entirely in Dr. Krippner's hands. Some people are hard to please. The consolation, for those who believe in ESP in dreams, is that this explanation, to negate the idea of precognition, concedes the reality of telepathy. The Dream Lab results were seen as strongly supportive of ESP in dreams, and there was the inevitable backlash from scientific orthodoxy. Various attempts were made to replicate the Maimonides test. Some were successful, but others were not. In particular, critics pointed to tests at the University of Wyoming, which failed to reproduce the Maimonides results. These were said to have nullified the findings of Ullman's dream telepathy experiments, but the Wyoming tests were far from the straightforward scientific experiments they appeared to be on the surface. At the center of this controversy was the most successful telepathic dreamer in the history of the Maimonides Project, Dr. Robert Van der Castle, the director of the Sleep and Dream Laboratory at the University of Virginia. Known as the King of the Dreamers, Dr. Van der Castle had been strikingly successful in picking up the thoughts of others in experiments at the Institute for Dream Research in Miami. At Maimonides he was positively sensational. From January to November, 1967, he made 8 tests, all of which were successful. Independent judges picked 5 of his tests as direct hits, and Van der Castle himself scored 6 direct hits. The odds for telepathy and against chance were 10,000 to 1. He had a great ability to recall dreams in depth. His transcripts, recalling a night's dreaming, could fill 60 to 70 pages. An average dreamer might complete 20 to 30. Dr. Van der Castle went to Wyoming with high hopes, as the clear champion of the cause of dream telepathy. After 2 weeks, the verdict was that he failed to demonstrate the phenomenon, and the scientific world generally shrugged its shoulders and turned away. But that failure in 1971 was not all it seemed. Before the very last test at Wyoming, the result of the whole series hung in the balance. If Dr. Van der Castle scored a hit with the final target picture, the series could be construed as supportive of telepathic influences. If he scored a miss, it would be judged a failure and the Maimonides' results would not have been replicated. Shortly before the final dream session, the sender of the target picture, with whom Dr. Van der Castle had already scored two direct hits, was taken ill and replaced. The substitute was a person with whom Van der Castle had achieved no successes at all. After the night's dreaming, as part of the normal procedure, before he was shown any possible target pictures, Van der Castle was asked what the target picture might look like. He said, it would deal with a foreign culture or people from a foreign culture. Maybe something like a hippie culture within America, which would be sort of like a foreign culture, the element of exotic or foreign culture, far away places kind of thing. You might think it would not be too difficult to identify such a picture, if there was one within the target group of 8. Unfortunately, there were no fewer than 7 pictures of that type. Choosing the right one became a lottery. He wrote afterwards that 7 of the 8 were thematically similar pictures that showed people from a foreign culture or an ethnically distinct subculture in America. Dr. Van der Castle failed to place the target picture high enough, which meant that the series was adjudged a failure. From the first day of the test, he had complained to the organizers that the pictures being chosen were too similar in theme, many lacked impact and were in black and white. I was particularly distressed at the lack of emotionality and content differentiation in the picture pool, he said. In Ullman and Krippner's book Experiments in Dream Telepathy, Dr. Van der Castle has written an illuminating appendix, comments on the replication failure by the failing subject. He notes that at Maimonides, subjects for dream telepathy who had just had a night of being repeatedly woken up, were given an interval of several weeks to get over any sleep deprivation caused by the test, before doing another. At Wyoming, all their tests were completed in 2 weeks, sometimes with only a single day between experiments. Years earlier, Professor J.B. Ryan, of Duke University, North Carolina, the pioneer of modern psi research, wrote that for exceptionally high ESP scoring, it was conducive to have an atmosphere of contagious enthusiasm and intense audience appreciation. Did the skeptical atmosphere of the experiments at Wyoming change and distort the test results? Dr. Van der Castle writes, at Maimonides, the staff always gave me the feeling I was a visiting sultan and the red carpet was rolled out with a flourish. At Wyoming, not only was the weather cold but the reception also. None of this means Dr. Van der Castle is a whinging parapsychologist claiming he has been bushwhacked by the scientific establishment. That is made clear by Dr. David Folks, one of the scientists who supervised the Wyoming tests. In retrospect, we may have erred too much on the side of scientism to the exclusion of creating conditions in which telepathy, if it exists at all, might reasonably be expected to flourish. It proved hard to escape the role of protector of scientific purity or guardian of the scientific morals. Were we sympathetic and encouraging observers, or scientific detectives out to prevent a crime from being committed before our very eyes? Particularly revealing personally was a brief moment of intrapsychic panic when it seemed as though some telepathic influence might be coming through. How could it be? Where had I failed to prevent a leakage? Our subject, Van der Castle, clearly felt himself on trial before a not entirely sympathetic jury, and we could not totally avoid the feeling that we too were on trial, with a favorable verdict for the subject raising doubts as to the scrupulosity of our judgment process. There's no place for sloppy dream research, whether on telepathy or anything else. But being too rigorous is a different matter from insecurely flaunting one's rigor as we may have done in our first study. Dr. Folks was courageous enough to make his reservations public. Of course, there were other tests that failed to replicate the dream lab results, but Dr. Folks has said something fundamental about the scientific attitude to dream research and parapsychology overall. Dr. Ryan has also commented on this. The fear that retards the scientific acceptance of psi is a social one, the fear of losing caste in one's profession. Whether dream studies have added to the evidence for telepathy is difficult to evaluate. Dr. Gardner Murphy in 1973, in the foreword to Dream Telepathy, summed up what was known all about psi, and nothing seems to have changed since. Even the analogy with electricity is still in use today. What are these hidden powers at work within us? Our 17th century ancestors knew that blankets gave off sparks in the cold weather.